And so, you know, there's lots of different types of motivations, and everyone needs those extrinsic, you know, everybody needs a salary and bonuses and all that stuff. Those are good things, but intrinsic motivations, like feeling purpose and value in the work that you do beyond those financial measures, makes someone stay in their job longer, and it makes them feel purpose in their job. And so why not align purpose and value in a job with customer experience and customer expectations? It forms this symbiotic kind of relationship where everybody wins.
Helping you create loyal customers and loyal employees, all through the power of simplicity. This is the Simple Brand Podcast, now heard around the world, including Lagos, Nigeria. I'm your host, Matt Wiles, and this week I'm talking with Greg Kilstrom. Greg's a speaker, an entrepreneur, and a consultant to top companies on marketing technology, customer experience, and digital transformation. He's the host of the Agile Brand Podcast, and he's a best-selling author of 4 customer experience books, including his latest, House of the Customer, a blueprint for one-to-one, customer-first, employee-driven business transformation. Look, I know you know that delivering a customer experience that puts the customer first is the key to brand out from the crowd. But the larger and more siloed your company gets, the harder that is to do across the board. So Greg and I discussed just how to do that using his House of the Customer blueprint. It's based on 7 key elements that align your people, align your processes, and align your platforms to deliver a truly customer-centric experience across every single interaction. So here it is. Here's my interview with Greg Kilstrom. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Great to be here. Looking forward to this.
Yeah. Well, congrats. Congrats on House of the Customer. This is your 11th book. Is that right?
Yeah, done a few, but no, really, really proud of this book, and yeah, looking forward to talking about it.
Well, it's certainly needed today, but I'm curious from your perspective, what drove you to write it today? Why do brands need House of the Customer today?
Yeah, so really, there were two things that I wanted to accomplish with it. And so in my work, I often work with, Fortune 1000 companies, generally on the large side of that even. And I've been working with a few companies over the last couple of years and seen where there's an understanding that we need to have better customer experience, and we need better measurement, we need better delivery, we need a more holistic experience. But the big questions are really, how do we get there, and where should we be steering towards? And so I wanted to accomplish two things, which is one, kind of outline North Star goals, which every company, particularly in the enterprise, every company should really be headed towards these things. And then I didn't want to just leave it at that and have these great pie in the sky ideas of even large companies are not there yet with some of these things. But I wanted to also help lay a foundation and give people practical steps of how do you get there, and how do you know where the areas of weakness are in your organization that you need to shore up in order to get there. And I use the metaphor of a house and the component parts of that to kind of talk about the individual areas, and also give people in the enterprise an understanding of, you know, where they can get started and some practical things to do.
Well, and so when we think about that approach, we think about like the need for customer centricity, what is it that customer-centric companies are doing that's different from everybody else?
Yeah, I think it really comes down to, if you ask any leader in any organization, you know, is the customer important? Of course, they're going to say yes, right? Yeah. It's the, you know, everything from the little hangers you get from your dry cleaner says, we love our customers. You know, everybody is on board with that idea, but it really comes down to what do they prioritize? You know, when you have a public company, yeah, with shareholders and numerous stakeholders and leaders that say, yes, we got to focus on customer experience. They know, they've read the stats that we all have, that, you know, customer experience is one of the key points of competition these days. But what really matters is companies that prioritize customer experience. And when it comes down to it, they prioritize the customer over other short-term goals or they find even better, they find ways to integrate short-term goals with making the customer happier as well. And that's, I think, what practical customer centricity really is.
Yeah. Yeah. No one will say that they don't want to focus on the customer. And I don't know if you're familiar with Capgemini's disconnected customer study, but I think the stats are, you know, brand leaders, about 75% of brands say that they deliver a customer-centric experience. When you ask those same customers, it's the customers that believe that 30% of them actually give a customer-centric experience. So there's like a gap of delusion.
Right. And there's several things within that. I mean, one, at least there's the intent. And, you know, but I think it does show the gap in a number of ways. You know, it shows the gap between just saying things and delivering on them. And it also shows that what leaders believe is a good customer experience are not necessarily what customers believe. And I think that also shows a gap between leaders and the employees that report to them. You know, when employees are empowered to create better experiences for customers, then I think you have better results. Good leaders in customer-centric organizations really kind of understand that they kind of need to step out of the way sometimes and let their employees really lead the charge.
And I think that kind of aligns with your approach, with your mindset around creating that North Star, whether it's like, you know, North Star or think of the military, the commander's intent. Here's the point where we want to get to. Now, you've got some guidelines, some margin on how you get there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, that's that North Star. Some brands are already there in some of these areas, but they have shortcomings in others. But I think that's the other thing is that brands are continually one-upping, and consumers, you know, if you buy a car, you don't only just buy cars, right? You also purchase many, many other things. And so your experience doing one thing, you all of a sudden have expectation. I mean, the easy example there is Amazon next day shipping, right? It's, you know, you get something next day. When are you ever going to be satisfied getting something 14 days later? Like that ship has sailed, no pun intended. So even small mom and pop stores have to now find a way to get next day or worst case second or third day delivery to keep up with Amazon. And that's just one example of these rising consumer expectations.
Well, and I think that speaks to something that some leaders are starting to understand, not enough understand, is that customers aren't really just comparing you to your direct competitors. They're comparing you to everybody else, to every other brand that they interact with. So if Amazon can deliver something to them in one day, then they expect everything else to be done, you know, within their reason, at least, within one day.
Yeah, I mean, and this is great news for some of those industries that have been thinking about this stuff for years and years and years, and it's terrible news for those that haven't. And so, you know, you see industries like financial services and healthcare, you know, both industries that I work with, you know, a fair amount, but, you know, a little behind the times on customer experience in a number of ways versus hospitality and other areas that they've had frontline employees kind of leading the charge and for a number of years, they're a little bit ahead. Not always perfect, of course, but we can probably all name, you know, bad experiences, but they've been solving these problems for decades. And as opposed to, you know, some of these other companies that really haven't, or with all the cookie changes and all third-party data issues, these companies that have never been direct to consumer before and now all of a sudden are trying to find ways to have direct relationships, it's brand new to them. And they may have been around 100 years in some cases.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and then when you think of some of these industries, like where this is not the case, then that does create a really good opportunity for somebody to acknowledge the value behind this, to really take hold of it, and then to do all the things that help them leapfrog over everybody else in their industry.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is why, you know, disruption certainly keeps being a buzzword, I guess. But, you know, why the taxi industry was so easy to disrupt, or why these fintech apps and things like that popped up so easily, is because those industries were fair game. I mean, it would be harder to disrupt some other types of industries. Although, again, you know, Airbnb and hospitality, you know, there's others that just kind of popped up, found the gap in customer experience and exploited it, for lack of a better term. And so, yeah, to your point, you've got competitors trying to one-up each other. You've got disruptors trying to get in. And then you've got completely different industries that are setting expectations that, you know, that now that's the par for the course at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you're having, you know, great customer experience examples, great customer experience brands, completely different industries that are setting the standard where customers say, well, if this company can make me feel this way, why can't this company make me feel this way too?
Yeah. Yeah.
You talk about creating a customer first approach. So what does it mean to put the customer first?
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of companies that may misunderstand this. The way I think about it is, you know, if you just invest in customer experience only from the outside in, let's just say, it's not going to be long-term and sustainable. I think the way that a truly sustainable customer first organization operates is they involve the employees in creating that experience. I look at it as it's like this flywheel effect of,
yeah,
if you motivate employees with, okay, your job is aligned with customer expectations and customer satisfaction, therefore your motivation is to create great experience, and your reward is when those customers have a great experience. And so, you know, there's lots of different types of motivations, and everyone needs those extrinsic, you know, everybody needs a salary and bonuses and all that stuff. Those are good things, but intrinsic motivations, like feeling purpose and value in the work that you do beyond those financial measures, makes someone stay in their job longer, and it makes them feel purpose in their job. And so why not align purpose and value in a job with customer experience and customer expectations? It forms this symbiotic kind of relationship where everybody wins. And the companies that do that and have been doing that, they are the ones that we talk about when we talk about good experience. You know, there's,
yeah,
probably count them on two hands, maybe at most, but they really put that first.
Well, when you focus on like that intrinsic value, when you focus on the purpose, a lot of times I think when people hear about, you know, like purpose-driven companies, a lot of times it seems like it's more like those that are doing really great work in the world, usually nonprofit companies. But you're saying that that doesn't have to be the case, that any company, any brand can have a purpose and can show that purpose to their employees.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of different types of intrinsic motivators. I've done a fair amount of work in this space on the employee experience side. And there are those that they want to do good. They want to help others. And at the same time, a for-profit company needs to make money, and they, yeah, they can't create good experiences for customers if they're not making money, right? So I think there needs to be a balance. I'm a strong supporter of those that, you know, they do good in the world outside of their immediate area of products and services. But sustainability-wise, they also have to find ways to, you know, motivate employees to do better work within the company. And sometimes doing well means mentoring a fellow employee, or, you know, helping others, helping interns learn more about the industry and things like that. So it can take some other approaches like that. And there's a lot of these intrinsic motivators, like learning and, you know, other areas where, again, it makes you feel like you have more purpose in your work, and that when you go to work, whether you stay at home or work in the office or work in a factory, wherever you work, you have more purpose in what you do, because you know that what you're doing accomplishes something. It's not just clocking in, clocking out. It's, you know, it's feeling purpose. And that matters so much. Customers feel that too.
So kind of recognizing the role that as an employee, helping your employees, recognizing the role that they play in helping their customer accomplish whatever goals they want to accomplish. But then it sounds like, too, when it comes to creating an employee-driven organization, but also, you know, also connecting your employees to each other, helping them see what they're doing to help each other either perform better in their role or to get more out of their role.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big proponent of agile approaches and agile principles. I mean, I'm an agile certified coach. I wouldn't call myself dogmatic or you know, religious in terms of agile. Go, there are people like that, but I don't think there's only one way to do it. But I think that agile principles can lend a lot. And one of the big principles in agile is teamwork and collaboration, and that
right.
You know, you put good people in a room together, they decide how work gets done. It's not some boss sitting disconnected that tells everyone what to do. Teams work together, they decide how work gets done, when it gets done, and as long as it fits the business priorities, it gets done. And you know, so I'm a big proponent that, you know, you hire the right people, let them do good work and show them their connection to the customer, show them their connection to the business, and then let them do great stuff.
Yeah. Well, and you cover collaboration in the book too. So what's the ideal way to have your teams create effective collaboration?
Yeah, I mean, I do think whether you call it agile or whatever you call it, doing things iteratively, starting small, experimenting, really building a culture of experimentation within the organization is going to lend. I'm sure you've seen statistics as well. These big digital transformation projects, 70% of them fail to meet their goals because they're like these 3-year treks to nowhere sometimes, where great ideas and visionary people, I'm sure, that sketched out some 300-page PowerPoint with a bunch of stuff in it. But if you create a 3-year long project where it takes 3 years to see any results, you're never going to get there. And so start small, create proofs of concepts, minimal viable products. These are lean, startup, agile kind of principle things, but they work well even in the enterprise. And, you know, start small, prove the value of something or not. You know, sometimes not everything has to work. And I think that's the other key thing here for leaders to understand is fail is a bad word, I realize, but it's okay to have proved that something doesn't work. That is as valuable as proving that something does work in many cases. Because you don't spin your wheels and you don't waste time, you can move on to a different experiment or a different hypothesis and things like that. And so doing things iteratively, being okay with not achieving goals because the stakes are low, if the initiative is small, that's how you get where you need to go. That's how you reach those North Star goals. That's how any company can truly succeed in this environment.
Yeah, and I think you'd said in the book, whether it's a 3-year plan or I think even an 18-month plan is a exercise in futility. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, unless it's very, very iterative all along the way, like trying to think that, I mean, who at the beginning of 2020, you know, if you made a 2-year plan at the beginning of 2020, that thing got thrown out the window 4 months into the year. And so let's learn, if nothing else. I mean, again, you know, terrible things happened during the pandemic, but let's learn from these opportunities. A lot of brands were able to just come to the realization that they had to be nimble, that they couldn't just make these big plans that, you know, we'll worry about that in 2 years. And, you know, if the average lifespan of a C-level exec is, you know, 12 to 18 months, I don't know what the exact stats are.
Right.
Chances are they won't even be around when that thing was supposed to launch. And so let's instead think, let's have quick wins, but substantive wins. And then we actually get there and the team on the ground doing the work can feel motivated by that too. And not just say, oh, wow, my job's going to change in 3 years, but I don't know what that looks like.
Yeah. It's like, okay, like this big goal is 3 years out. We'll keep our heads down and do a little work now, knowing that sometime within the next 2.5 years, either another executive is going to come in and just throw it all out and create something new, or this current executive will say, you know what, I changed my mind. Here's the new goal.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. That happens a lot. So yeah, having that iterative approach can be motivating. You're able to see a snowball effect really in how you're able to improve things and then quickly learn, apply those learnings and then keep improving.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's that feedback loop that really keeps people going. And again, yeah, it allows you to course correct when you see something that isn't working, or maybe it doesn't have to straight out fail and get a 0%, but it might not perform as well as you'd like it to. And so constant experimentation, is really key, particularly when there's so many, as we were talking about earlier, there's so many points of competition, there's so many points of differentiation, and there's constantly rising expectations and all of these, it sounds like a lot of, I think it's exciting. Like, it's, to me, it gets me out of bed in the morning. Like, I'm excited to solve these challenges. But if you don't have a plan of how you're going to attack these, then, it can be daunting.
I think that's why it helps to have that North Star focus, that North Star goal. So, like, not focusing so much on here's the exact thing that we have to solve for, but taking it up to that higher level. So can you elaborate more on your approach to these North Star goals that we need to have?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's four that I outline in the book, and I'll just quickly go through them here, and I'm happy to talk more about them. But the first one is to have a personalized one-to-one omni-channel customer experience. So there's a lot of buzzwords in there, so I'll just unpack that for a minute here. Is what this really means is every individual feels like the brand really gets them and understands them because they're getting the right content, the right offer, the right type of experience that they want on the channel that they prefer, whether that's their smartphone or their laptop or in-store, whatever. They're getting it at the right time based on their own behavior. So how that's done, there's a lot of different ways to do it. There's a lot of technology and data and all those things involved, but really, the end goal is the feeling that the brand that I support gets me and gives me the right thing at the right time. The second one is brands need to have a first-party customer data strategy. And what that means is not only they have the data about their customers to enable the first thing that I talked about, that one-to-one experience, but also that they are careful stewards of their customers' data. I mean, this is not only are there regulations, Europe kind of led the way with GDPR, but here in the States, California has CCPA, even where I'm based in Virginia, they just passed something, and various states within the US, around the world, are passing different data privacy regulations. So it's kind of this balance between we need a lot of information about our customers in order to provide experiences that are relevant to them, but we also have to be entrusted with that data by our customers and prove that we can be. So that's the second one. The third one is building a customer lifetime value model, which means, I come from the marketing world and very, new customer acquisition focused. And, when I ran my agency, we weren't as focused on customer loyalty programs and retention. We were a lot more focused on new customer acquisition, which always will be important. Marketing, advertising for those new customers, always important. But what we're seeing now, brands more and more, and some of it I think is driven by economic conditions or fear of worse economic conditions right now, but I think this is here to stay, is brands are more and more focused on building that loyalty and long-term customer value. And so building a lifetime value model means that we can truly understand, okay, we get someone in the door, how do we keep them? How do we create great experiences, keep them loyal, keep them active, and create a lot of value, not only for us, but also for them over their lifetime. And it becomes a win-win situation.
Right.
And then the last one is kind of what we were talking about earlier about the culture, which is an agile customer-centric culture. So that's how all of this stuff gets sustained. And, if we're thinking, if we're nimble, if we approach things iteratively and with a culture of experimentation, and we all can see alignment to the customer and everything that we do, that will sustain those other three goals.
Yeah, absolutely. It kind of helps feed them. So I want to talk about that first one for personalization. Where do you think brands are going wrong when it comes to personalization?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not even so much wrong, maybe, that they're not thinking broadly enough about, they're thinking very single channel. So like, let's make the website as personalized as possible. I see this a lot. And, a lot of this has to do with in a large organization, there's a web team and there's an email team and there's a CRM team. You know, it's like, you know, some of these, Brett, I know you're familiar with large orgs as well. It's like talking to someone on another planet sometimes to get someone from one team to another. And this is only within the marketing function. And so,
yeah.
You know, let's talk about regions and products and divisions and, you know, all of those other things, like all this stuff kind of compounds. And so getting one channel optimized and personalized is definitely, it's an undertaking, but that's where I think brands need to think beyond that and think multi-channel, omni-channel, you know, every channel. That is a North Star for most brands. Some are getting it fairly close these days even, but I think to get it cross-channel where, again, if I have a preference to receive text versus emails, a brand starts to understand that and starts to use my channel of preference. That's where I think brands need to start focusing more and more. And again, sometimes you're seeing this, but even large ones are struggling to kind of make those connections and breaking down their own silos.
Oh yeah. Well, and a lot of times it's the silos that create a lot of the hassles, a lot of the friction, whatever it is that irritates customers going throughout the customer experience. And it's like a lot of times, like when a customer complains about something, you know, like one team will say, well, that's not our fault. That's this team over here. Well, it's everyone's fault for not being connected. But yeah, it sounds like that focus on having an agile, customer-centric culture should help to break down or at least connect the silos.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's where, you know, when we see our role in terms of the customer and not in terms of I'm in charge of email, you know, that helps. Again, there's lots of other bureaucracy and there's data silos and there's platform silos. There's all kinds of things that need to be broken down, but we can start with teams feeling like they're connected with one another because they're all aligned in terms of let's make an actual good experience for the customer, not just a good website experience or a good email experience or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, to me, that speaks to helping ensure that every team is involved in the customer experience, not just even the customer facing teams.
Yeah, absolutely. That's where feedback loops of having every team understand that, yes, I mean, your numbers may have gone up last month, but overall numbers went down, you know, customer satisfaction scores, NPS, whatever, however you measure that, you know, kind of barometer of customer satisfaction. You start when you can align everybody on that, on a single or, you know, small set of measurements. I believe that's the power of some of those measurements is to help everybody see, okay, we've got to work together. We can't, and, you know, net promoter score or customer satisfaction, it doesn't just apply to one channel or one, you know, one product. It applies to the entire brand when it's done well.
And that can tie back to helping your employees recognize part of their purpose. You know, if you look at NPS, if you look at these metrics, no matter who you are, no matter what team you're in, what role can you play in helping improve the score? And it's not just thinking, you know, well, that didn't really tie to me. Like, I have no bearing on that. Well, what can you do? What if you did? What would you be able to do to help improve that score in your role, in your team?
Yeah. I mean, I recommend often as a first step to kind of get there is for managers and leaders to start. It sounds so simple. It's almost silly, but like rewrite job descriptions in terms of how the role relates to the customer. And I mean, any job role within the company, you would be hard pressed. I'm sure someone out there will find a job that it's really difficult to do this with, but rewrite job descriptions in terms of how they serve customers. And then all of a sudden you start thinking, even as a manager, you start thinking about how this relates. Everyone within the org can start thinking that way as well. And to your point, that shared goal, that shared metric or set of metrics, everybody isn't just thinking in their own little fiefdoms and stuff like that. They're thinking about, you know, a shared purpose.
Well, I want to talk about the house of the customer blueprints, because you've defined like these blueprints to help organizations deliver a customer-centric experience. So can you walk me through the different elements of the blueprint?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, yeah, I use this the metaphor of the house just to try to keep it simple and straightforward and yet have enough detail. But what I've found lacking sometimes in some of the other maturity frameworks and other methodologies is there's just not necessarily enough detail. I mean, you know, we're talking about large organizations with lots of moving pieces, and you don't want to think in terms of departmental silos either. So, you know, how do we think across the org and yet give enough detail to be able to say, and you know, I have a maturity framework that I use and that comes with the book as well, to be able to measure individual areas of the business. And I think that's really important, because somebody out there may say, you know what, this one area, we're really strong in this, we don't need help. That's great. But there's, you know, I go through seven different areas. So I'll just kind of talk through them really quickly here. The roof of the house is the processes and the system. So they are the things that, you know, kind of cover everything and protect us when we don't know what to do. The processes and systems are kind of there to help us. And the two walls on either sides are the business objectives and then the business outcomes. Because really, as much as we may want to serve customers, we can't have a business without profits and sustainability and all those things. So we, you know, we have to have a functioning business that understands what it needs and gets what it needs in order to do that. In the middle are the three pillars, and they're really centered around the customer, which are understanding our customers. So having enough data about our customers so that we can deliver those personalized experiences, so that we understand what they need, what they, you know, what they purchased, all of those kinds of things. The second one is to serve the customer. And so we need platforms that are enabled by the data that we have and able to serve content, offers, experiences, all types of things to those customers, really enabling the customer experience. And then finally, we have listening to the customer, which is taking all that, you know, we have the data that feeds the experiences. Now we need to understand what is going on, what's working, what's not. And so listening to the experiences and learning from them. And the foundation of our house is that agile customer-centric culture that really enable. This is all driven by employees. Leaders need to set the vision, they need to set the objectives, and then they need to have great people that are really creating these experiences and making it sustainable.
I love how like that all comes together, like, you know, to be able to show like, here's the foundation, here are the pillars, here's the roof. But you know, with those different elements, is there an ideal sequence to take that helps prioritize different elements before others?
Yeah, I mean, I think I do think you have to start with the business objectives that you need to accomplish. And, you know, because again, I don't think you can truly be as customer centric as we want to be. I don't think you can be successful as a business without understanding what you need to do. And then I think it comes to quickly aligning that with the customer experience. I created this not necessarily for a startup organization to really start from scratch. So my intent with this really was, any large organization has all of the stuff in place. It's more about how do we stop thinking about, well, I'm on the customer experience team, or I'm in the marketing department or whatever. And let's start thinking about you kind of reframing things in terms of the customer. And in terms of where to start, I would say, you know, start with the business objectives at the very beginning, but then really begin at the foundation of the culture. Like, start changing the culture to start thinking about these things in terms of customer centricity. And then as long as you're, you know, adhering to those objectives, you should be on the right path.
You talked about one of the elements being the processes. I've heard you talk about how people and processes can be one of the greatest roadblocks, or can be the thing that makes your customer experience successful. So what can you do to make sure that they're not roadblocks and actually do make your effort successful?
Yeah, definitely. And this came out of, you know, I've been involved in several transformation, you know, projects and initiatives. And, you know, these things have often started as, you know what, we need a new platform to do X, Y, and Z. And so, you know, once we have this platform in place, everybody's life is going to be easy, and customers are going to be happy, teams are going to be happy, and everything. So in other words, lots of things start as a platform, you know, problem, but also a platform solution. But what really ends up either making or breaking those things is the people using those platforms and the processes that the people are using to use the platforms. That's where, you know, again, just investing in new software, it's not going to make a difference unless the people using it start using it well and change their processes. And, you know, you have people in a role doing things a certain way, 5, 10 years in some, I know there's more turnover these days, but still you have people that are very ingrained in doing things a certain way. And then all of a sudden you're saying, well, you know what? The way you're doing things is wrong. We're going to replace everything that you do with this piece of software and good luck, right? How's that going to work? Like that, you're going to, either that person's going to leave, they're going to be disgruntled, or, you know, some combination of the two. And so, you know, involving people early, helping them create and design the processes, being part of that, the processes that the new platforms will enable, that's the way that you become successful. And then your people are bought in. Nobody loves change, but they're more bought in and they're more open to change. And they start to see the opportunity for themselves and their role, and hopefully, ideally, make their jobs better, easier, and help, you know, accomplish those end goals as well.
And I think it would also help if you take that agile mindset, that agile approach on your processes as well, realizing that, you know, they can be iterative. They don't have to be set in stone.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, yeah, absolutely agree. I mean, a setup for failure is one day we do things this way that we've been doing it for 10 years. And then the next day, everything changes. How can that possibly go smoothly? Right. So I completely agree. Like, you roll these things out with pilot projects, you get advanced teams involved, get them excited about this stuff. And then they kind of evangelize to other team members, and you train the trainer approach of, like, you know, start small, keep building, and get more and more people involved. And then when peers see their, you know, when someone sees their peers involved in this and doing it and happy about doing it, they're a lot more likely than some, you know, I'm a consultant, but then some consultant coming in saying, you guys are doing everything wrong. Now you need to do everything differently. You know, people like me enable this stuff and can help with the vision and the strategy, but it really takes the team members to be on board and make this stuff work, because they're the ones that are going to be doing it in the long term.
Right. And they're the ones that are going to see, like, within the details where it does, where it doesn't work, or certain situations that might cause it to not work.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there is no way that a consultant that's been involved for 3 months can know the history of, you know, 10 years back, this happened or whatever, you know. And I think there's good and bad. I mean, sometimes, you know, that's kind of a hindrance to being able to see the vision. And so that's where, again, external, I'm a consultant, so maybe I'm a little biased here, but external eyes and ears and stuff are sometimes very helpful in just kind of getting past the legacy stuff and some of the burdens of what might have gone wrong because it was approached the wrong way. But to your point, the people that are actually doing the work and hands-on, they're going to see a detail that I could never foresee. But together we work it out, and, you know, I bring experience from another org that I work with that might have been a little similar or maybe vastly different, but bring new ideas into an org. And I think that relationship and that dynamic can work really well.
That's it. Well, I see a lot of debate back and forth where some people say that everyone should own the customer experience, or that customer experience should be owned by a certain team or a certain leader. So what are your thoughts on owning and governing the customer experience?
Yeah, it's definitely a hotly debated issue, right? So yeah, I do think someone needs to own in the sense of setting the vision for the customer experience and really be responsible for the measurements and really the vision of what it should look like. But customer experience should not be the sole responsibility of a department or a team or something like that. Everyone needs to, kind of going back to talking about job descriptions, like, everyone should see their part in building a good customer experience. But I don't think a purely democratic, like, okay, if we're all thinking about the customer, all of a sudden the customer's going to have a great experience. I don't think it really works like that in reality. I think it, all of that, everybody needs to be motivated and aligned towards that. But there does need to be some people that are really solely focused on it and thinking about it. And so, you know, I think it in that way, whether it's a department or a team or whatever, I think it's really valuable. But those people need to be involved with everyone from customer service and tech support to, you know, marketing and even HR. And they need to be involved with everyone in the org. Like that, it's the most horizontal part of the organization, in other words.
Yeah. So when it comes to silos, like they definitely shouldn't be siloed.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But I think the legacy of this is that it often grew out of either customer service, you know, yeah, a lot of CX professionals came from customer service, a lot, some like myself come from marketing. And, you know, so we have baggage that comes with us, right? It's like, we think of it in terms of, well, I think of it in terms of marketing, but this person thinks of it in terms of customer service. And so, you know, it's sort of incumbent upon a CX professional to really understand how the entire business works and how old, I mean, even, you know, the finance team, like what happens when you pay a bill late, you know, and you have to talk to the billing department, like that's customer experience. You know, those people are not necessarily trained in CX and all that stuff, but they have a very, very vital role in the customer experience. And, you know, in larger orgs that's often handled in different ways, but in a small organization, like often that's a person that you call or a small team that you call, and customer experience varies widely versus calling your account rep or something like that.
Of course. And that just goes back to what we were talking about earlier around that North Star goal of ensuring a customer-centric culture, helping everybody, like no matter what team you're on, you know, even if it's finance, helping them understand how they impact the customer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Greg, I have learned a lot from you today. I've learned a lot from your book, but where can people go to learn more?
Yeah, absolutely. So two places. So one, I'm very active on LinkedIn, so I highly recommend you can search for me, LinkedIn, drop me a note, would be happy to connect there. And then my website is gregkilstrom.com. So you can find the book there, find information about consulting, and I do speaking and workshops and things like that as well. So love to hear from you.
Excellent. Well, thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you for your time here today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Really enjoyed it.
I hope you enjoyed my discussion with Greg Kilstrom. You can go and learn more from him at gregkilstrom.com. You'll find access to House of the Customer and his other books, along with opportunities for Greg to help your business. From speaking engagements to workshops and training to consulting, Greg can help you ensure your brand is truly customer-centric and employee-driven. And hey, if you're enjoying the Simple Brand podcast, go ahead and hit the subscribe button, because it's going to make it so much simpler for you to get future episodes like the next one featuring Robert Patton. Robert's an international best-selling author, and he's the founder of Creative Agency Success, a consulting firm dedicated to helping creative agencies scale. And he's the host of the Agency Blueprint podcast. Hey, Blueprint, I think I'm seeing a theme here. Greg and I discuss his lessons on how to take your team's operations from complex and out of hand to a simple, scalable machine. A machine that helps you ultimately have more time to focus on the right work to move your business forward. So go ahead and subscribe. You'll automatically get Robert's episode as soon as it's live. Until then, keep it simple.